13. The evolution of cultural evolution. You can't do much carpentry with your bare hands, and you can't do much thinking with your bare brain. Bo Dalbaum. Darwinian beginnings. Recall our preview in Chapter 7. Generations of naturalists have established that animal parents can impart skills and preferences to their offspring without benefit of verbal instruction. And these animal traditions are a sort of mimetic evolution. But animals' memes do not, in general, open up opportunities for further memes the way words do. There is none of the snowballing accumulation of the sort that language permits. And, as noted in Chapter 12, there are ecologically relevant, indeed life-threatening, facts about perpetually absent circumstances, such as what do you do if you encounter a bear, that simply cannot be conveyed without language. Displaced reference is, as Bickerton and others argue, a giant step in design space. It is time at last to flesh out the central claim of Part 2 of this book. Human culture started out profoundly Darwinian, with uncomprehending competences generating various valuable structures in roughly the way termites build their castles. Over the next few hundred thousand years, cultural exploration of design space gradually de-Darwinized as it developed cranes that could be used to build further cranes that lifted still more cranes into operation, becoming a process composed of ever more comprehension. How far could H. sapiens get with only ape-level comprehension? We may figure this out someday, if we get enough evidence to fix rough dates on such milestones as cooperative hunting and scavenging, control of fire, building habitation, making various tools and weapons. But we know that everything changed once language got in place. Consider a diagram. Human culture started in the lower left corner and gradually spread out to include pockets of growing comprehension up the vertical y-axis, more top-down control along the horizontal x-axis, and more efficient directed search on the front-to-back z-axis. I am claiming that these three dimensions naturally get traversed in a diagonal direction from pure Darwinian toward the ultimately unreachable summit of intelligent design, because the phenomena arrayed along each dimension are ordered by their use of more and more semantic information, and hence design improvements, which require more R&D, more gathering and exploiting and refining, building, as always, on the foundations established by earlier, more Darwinian R&D. Some steps are larger than others, but we don't need what Freeman Dyson called a gift from God to have arrived where we are today. We will look closely at the controversies surrounding the current state of cultural evolution after we have reviewed the Darwinian and semi-Darwinian and hemi-semi-demi-Darwinian phenomena that led to it. We set the stage in Chapter 12. Memes, like viruses, are symbionts dependent on the reproductive machinery of their hosts, which they exploit for their own ends, so for there to be a population explosion of memes, there has to have been a pre-existing or concurrently evolving instinct to imitate or copy, which would pay for itself by providing some genetic fitness benefit to our ancestors. The ancestors of our nearest non-human relatives apparently didn't enjoy conditions conducive to this, or didn't enjoy them for long enough to join us on the stepping stones. Chimpanzees and bonobos, for instance, don't exhibit the interest, the focused attention, the imitative talent required to kindle the cumulative cultural wildfire that marks us off from the other hominids. Future research may tip the balance in favor of one of the rival hypotheses about how this happened, but we have seen enough, I think, to rest assured that it didn't take a miracle to put us on the path. Once underway, we became the apes with meme-infected brains. Like viruses and other symbionts by the trillions that have taken up residence in our bodies, the invaders evolved to be more effective reproducers, holding their own against the competition within bodies and winning the dispersal competitions, spreading to new hosts. They must have included enough mutualists and commensals among the parasites not to kill off their hosts, though it is entirely possible that waves of meme infection did just that before one wave finally happened to be benign enough to secure a long-term foothold. We can imagine a group of would-be ancestors afflicted by a dance craze so potent that it led them to abandon hunting and gathering, leading to mass starvation, or an unfortunate lineage whose initiation into manhood was a circumcision ritual that cut off more and more in a misfiring variation of the peacock's tail. Similarly, in the early days, life may have evolved many times, only to fizzle out again and again, until one origin got enough of the details right enough, to survive indefinitely. The earliest memes, whether they were pronounceable proto-words or silent behavioral habits of other sorts, were synanthropic, not yet domesticated, and they had to be particularly infectious until the suite of genes and memes for enhancing the copying routines were in place. Probably only a minority of them had any functional capacities at all beyond their reproductive power. Bad habits, but catchy bad habits, would have been a price worth paying for a few really good habits. And once some of the good habits were in place, there would be time for both cultural and genetic R&D to go back and clean up some of the excesses, in much the way our genetic micromachinery has evolved measures for dealing with the troublemakers in the genome, such as genomic parasites, transposable elements, and segregation distorters. Once verbal communication became not just a good trick, but an obligatory talent for our species, there would be steady selective pressure in favor of organic modifications that enhanced or streamlined the process of language acquisition. Chief among the important innovations is altriciality, prolonged infancy, which extended the time offspring are dependent on parents for protection, nourishment, and, not at all inadvertently, education. This huge increase in face time was further enhanced by gaze monitoring, which in turn enabled shared attention, and, as Tomasello notes, shared intention. The only other mammal that regularly engages in gaze monitoring is the domestic dog, and it monitors the gaze of its human master, not other dogs. Compare the whites of the eyes of human beings to the dark sclera surrounding the pupils of other apes. This is probably a recent adaptation to enhance gaze monitoring, a fine example of cultural genetic coevolution, a genetic response to a novel behavior designed to enhance meme transmission. What was it like for these pioneer meme hosts? Was it like anything? Their heads were being filled with tools, toys, and junk, all made of information, occupying brain tissue and exploiting brain energy. But which of these invaders, if any, made themselves known in some way to their hosts? The germs and viruses that occupy our bodies fly beneath our radar except when they provoke large-scale somatic changes, pains, palpitations, vomiting, sneezing, dizziness, and the like. As we heard in Chapter 4, the ontology implicit in an elevator's design accounts for its competence in controlling its activities without the elevator having to comprehend what it is doing, without its having to be conscious in any but the most minimal sense of its ontology. It just has to be sensitive to it, to discriminate its elements and react differently to the differences. This is the ontology the engineers have hit upon for the elevator they designed. Our ancestors' ontologies could similarly have included words and other memes. They could have used these words competently and benefited from having words, for instance, without yet realizing that they were using words, without words being manifest to them as words in their manifest image. In a minimal sense, they would notice words. They would be perceptually sensitive to them and respond differentially, just like the elevator, but they wouldn't have to notice their noticing. Words could pass between them perceptually, entering and inhabiting their bodies rather like vitamins or their gut flora. valuable symbionts whose value didn't depend on being recognized or even appreciated by their hosts. Still, the natural home of memes is in our manifest image, not our scientific image, where the vitamins and gut flora are found. Memes can travel through the air only by generating human perceivable effects, so they are, in general, available for noticing, even while many enter inconspicuously and unannounced. Memes, then, unlike viruses and microbes, are affordances we are equipped from the outset to notice, to recognize, to remember, to respond to appropriately. They are items in good standing in our ontology, even while they are typically invisible to other animals, not part of their ontology at all. Here we should recall the distinction Sellars made between the manifest image and the more primitive, original image. When we notice our memes and start to own them and reflect on them, we have moved from the original image to the manifest image, the world we live in and know that we live in. The free-floating rationales of human communication. Competence without comprehension is as ubiquitous in human life as in animals, bacteria, and elevators. But we tend to overlook this possibility and assign appreciation of the rationales of successful human action to the clever actors involved. This is not surprising. After all, we tend to attribute more understanding to wolves and birds and honeybees than we can support with evidence. The use of the intentional stance to interpret behavior across all species carries with it a tacit presupposition of rationality. And whose rationality can it be if not the behavior's? The very idea of free-floating rationales is a strange inversion of reasoning, as we can see by following a family of controversies over many years provoked by some celebrated work in the philosophy of language. One of the landmarks of 20th century philosophy of language is H.P. Grice's account of the necessary conditions for communication, or what he called non-natural meaning. Grice's central claim was a three-part definition of what it is for a person to mean something by doing something. As clarified by Strawson and others, to mean something by doing X, S must intend, 1, X to produce a certain response R in a certain audience A, 2, A to recognize S's intention, 1, and 3, A's recognition of, 1, to function as at least part of A's reason for A's response R. This elegant recursive stack captures a lot. A may learn a good deal from something S does without S meaning something by doing it. For instance, 1, if S screams in pain or falls over in a faint, A may be informed that S is in some agony, but it may not have been S's intention to so inform A. It may be involuntary pain behavior. If, 2, S does have the intention to misinform A, but does not intend A to realize this. Think of a malingering soldier trying to get sent to the field hospital, or the injury-feigning bird. It also doesn't count as communication. Finally, 3, if it isn't A's recognition of this communicative intention that grounds A's belief, this is not a case of communication, however informative. For instance, my wife leaves the light on in the kitchen, so I will be sure to see the dirty dishes that I should clean up. She wants me to hop to it, but isn't necessarily sending me a message. In fact, she'd just as soon I not recognize her intention to draw my attention to my duties. Grice's analysis rings true for most who have encountered it, and it has inspired a flood of further theoretical work, much of it dealing with an apparently endless supply of ingenious counterexamples and problems. It draws attention to subtle differences in how human beings can interact, and in the process highlights subtleties that seem to be absent in animal communication systems. Does the anecdote about the vervet monkey who issues a false eagle alarm just when his tribe is losing a confrontation with a rival tribe, thereby provoking a cessation of hostilities that regains ground, provide a case of intentional deception, or is it a case of dumb luck? Stotting gazelles don't need the chasing lions to distinguish deliberate showing off from natural exuberance. The lions will leave them alone in any case if they stot. The inviting conclusion to draw, and many, including me, accepted the invitation, is that Grice's nested conditions show that human communicative behavior is of a different order from simpler, mere animal behavior, involving at least fourth-order intentionality. S, 1, intends A to, 2, recognize that S, 3, intends A to, 4, believe that P. Not only philosophers have been inspired by Grice. Anthropologists, psychologists Dan Sperber and Deirdre Wilson used Grice as a launching point for a rival theory of meaning, but they didn't demur from the general appreciation of Grice's insights. From a psychological point of view, the description of communication in terms of intentions and inferences also makes good sense. The attribution of intentions to others is a characteristic feature of human cognition and interaction. Ruth Millikan, in contrast, was at first firmly dismissive. If I believed that Jack the Ripper was under my bed, I would not crawl into bed and instantly fall asleep. In crawling so into bed, I clearly do not believe Jack is under my bed. But it does not follow that I believe Jack is not under my bed. Indeed, I may never have heard of Jack. Likewise, from the fact that if I had reason to believe that a speaker did not intend that I comply with an imperative, then likely I would not comply, it does not follow that in normal cases of compliance with imperatives, I believe that the speaker intends compliance. On the next page, she softens this. First, there is the problem just what it is to have a certain belief or intention. Then there is the problem what it is to use a belief in doing something, as opposed, for example, to merely having it while doing something. And we must also ask whether there is any need to interpret Gricean intentions and beliefs as things actually used while speaking and understanding, or whether they may have another status entirely, yet still do the work the Gricean theorists want them to do of distinguishing a kind of meaning that all non-natural signs have. Millikan, who stands out as a distinguished non-Gricean, eventually concludes, "Only Gricean beliefs that were actually used in the process of speaking and understanding could be of any interest to the theory of meaning." But this has not deterred others from adopting the Gricean program in one way or another. Recently, my colleague, Jody Azzouni, has confronted the Gricean analysis head-on, and it is worth noting the pains he must take to soften his readers up for his assault. My primary aim in this book isn't to refute Gricean and neo-Gricean approaches once and for all. Griceanism is too widespread, and its numerous proponents are far too varied in their individual approaches. And besides, he adds in a footnote, who needs to make that many enemies all at once? For students of the literature, Azzouni's patient and imaginative dissection is a must-read. But I highlight just one of the amusing intuition pumps he concocts to shock us into a non-Gricean perspective. Imagine two people on an island who speak two unrelated languages. He holds up an object and starts to mime an action, while she tries to figure out what he's trying to say. It probably doesn't get any more Gricean than that. She recognizes that he has communicative intentions. He recognizes that she recognizes that he has communicative intentions, and so on, iteratively maybe. Based on this, on the context, and on some other background mutual knowledge, they've been doing this sort of thing for a while, perhaps, and they've built up a repertoire of meanings, she tries to determine what he's trying to communicate and, derivatively, what the object he's holding up means. It doesn't get more Gricean than that, but, let's be honest, it doesn't get much more frustratingly atypical either. Real Gricean communication is a real pain, as anyone who's ever been forced to engage in it will angrily tell you. Azuni's example shows how everyday communication is hugely unlike Griceian communication. But then we have a puzzle. How could Grice have persuaded so many people that he was onto something original and important? Did he provoke a mass intellectual hallucination? Yes, in a way. Azuni's next sentence points in the right direction. Ordinary language may originate, evolutionarily speaking, in events somewhat like real Gricean communication events. But a great deal has changed since then, and in particular a great deal has changed in our brains. What Grice did, without realizing it, was to reverse engineer human communication, adducing the free-floating rationales that would naturally be uncovered by eons of cultural and genetic evolution once the basic good trick of using words as tools had been established. Just as when we explain the phenomena of the stotting gazelle and the murderous cuckoo chick, the façon de parler that naturally springs to our minds as the appropriate terms for explanation is the intentional stance, treating the agents as rational agents whose reasons are being exposed, without noting that these reasons did not have to be understood, noted, or even represented by the agents. Grice's point was, or should have been, that human communicators, once they catch on to the full power of the tools they have at their disposal, have the competence to exploit these features, and the competence to avoid being exploited by others exploiting those features. Remember, I have been suggesting that the acquisition of a language, and of memes more generally, is very much like the installation of a pre-designed software app of considerable power, like Adobe Photoshop, a tool for professionals with many layers that most amateur users never encounter. With human communication, there is much variation, and most uses of the system are rudimentary, routine, guided by habits that are themselves beneath the ken of most observers and self-observers. But the tools admit of some very sophisticated applications. Some people are natural manipulators, impression creators, masters of indirection, and almost subliminal blandishment. And others are bluff, direct, naive, unguarded in their speech, novice users of the tools, you might say. But neither kind of people have to comprehend the reasons why their everyday communication tools have all the options that they do. Our systems of verbal communication have been brilliantly designed by a process of natural cultural selection that has endowed them with a host of features that new users only gradually acquire and may never deeply comprehend. They may develop acute sensitivities to risks and dangers and opportunities in communication that they themselves cannot analyze. They may be able to smell a lie or an instance of false humility, for instance, without even seeing the speaker's face or hearing the tone of voice. Something about the choice of words didn't ring true in some way that is impenetrable to their efforts of analysis. Other speakers of a language may have the gift of gab or more specialized gifts, the power to comfort, to persuade, to seduce, to amuse, to inspire. This all comes naturally to some and is largely beyond the talents of others. Some, especially those on the autism spectrum, who are especially high-functioning, like Temple Grandin, manage to devise, with much effort and ingenuity, a genuine TOM, a theory of mind, to help them interpret the kaleidoscopic social world that most of us can perceive directly. We are also gradually acquiring theoretical understanding and genuine comprehension of the reasons for the features of our communication systems. Those who excel at this research often sell their services as intelligent designers of communication, public speaking coaches, marketing consultants, advertisers. But as we can confirm in other areas of human endeavor, jazz comes particularly to mind, theory is often no match for ear, even when it is good theory. If you have ever observed a brilliant scientist with Asperger's syndrome craft speech acts and other social ploys with impressive speed while unable to erase the telltale signs of contrivance, you can appreciate that if Grice's analysis were a performance theory, it would be applicable to a small minority of speakers. Projects of reverse engineering human activity via the intentional stance have been invented quite often by philosophers, though not in that guise. G.E.M. Anscombe, in her obscure masterpiece, Intention, talking about Aristotle's account of the practical syllogism, says, "If Aristotle's account were supposed to describe actual mental processes, it would in general be quite absurd. The interest of the account is that it describes an order which is there whenever actions are done with intentions." An order which is there? Where? Not in the brain, not in the environment, not represented anywhere. I submit she was crediting Aristotle with the discovery of the free-floating rationales that govern our most rational practical behavior without always being represented. So, even when words themselves have been appropriated as domesticated tools, and hence a part of the manifest image, it is possible that the free-floating rationale of the design of some of our practices is unimagined by us. Grice can be seen to have worked it out, seen the order which is there when people engage in non-natural meaning, and simply presented it as an account of their intentional states at the time. That's how natural our practice of over-endowing people with reasons is. It permits us to fall for mass hallucinations. Using our tools to think. It may be natural to imagine that when the toddler first says, "Doggy," as the dog walks by, she understands that she is labeling the thing she sees with a spoken word. But it is not obligatory. We must be particularly careful here not to confuse competence and comprehension. In fact, it is probably practically useful, however theoretically mistaken, for adults to presume much more understanding in their children's early utterances than the children actually have, since by thus scaffolding them into the conversation, they help their children grow into their language. Thus, proto-labelings pave the way for labelings, and proto-requests pave the way for requests. It may take hundreds of hours of conversation before the child really gets the hang of it, and even longer before children understand what they are doing when they are having a conversation. Recall from chapters 9 and 10 that a meme is a way of behaving or doing, internal or external, that can be transmitted from host to host by being copied. In other words, as we shall see later in this chapter, it is like a software app or applet. In fact, very like an app. A relatively simple informational structure designed, by natural selection in the early days, that can add a talent, a bit of know-how, useful or useless. Such apps are usually visible or audible to others when you run them, when the word gets heard or uttered, when the action gets observed or executed, and also visible or audible to yourself in the course of normal self-monitoring. You hear yourself speak, you see or feel yourself gesture, act, move, and so on. But it is one thing to hear yourself speaking, and quite another to notice that you're saying something. The child in primary school makes a telling slip of the tongue and calls his teacher Mommy, to the amusement of the class and his own red-faced embarrassment when he notices. Even adults often speak without realizing they are speaking. They are monitoring their verbal output, correcting mispronounced words perhaps, but still quite oblivious to the import of their actions, almost like talking in their sleep. We know they are monitoring themselves because they sometimes, too late, do a double take. Did I just say that? Did I really utter those words? I am proposing that we should imagine our pioneer language user ancestors jabbering away as volubly as you like, getting plenty of benefits from these new habits, even though they occasionally scared off their prey. Sometimes they barely managed to communicate, and sometimes they communicated with eloquence, but unwitting, not studied eloquence. And they only gradually came to recognize, retrospectively, what they had been doing. I submit that just as it never dawns on antelopes what they are doing when they are starting, it didn't have to dawn on these ancestors of ours what they were doing with words until they switched from unconscious selection, as Darwin so aptly called it, to methodical selection of fully domesticated memes. Children today make such a swift transition from babbling to speaking and understanding that it is all too easy to see it as a sudden phase shift, like Helen Keller's iconic trip to the water pump, an unforgettable anecdote, although of uncheckable accuracy. But in the early days of language, it was probably a much slower, less efficient process, not yet benefiting from genetic adjustments that streamlined acquisition by turning up the curiosity level for speech sounds, for instance, so that more attention, brain effort, was devoted to their analysis. I speculate that there was a gradual, incremental process of growing competence leading to self-monitoring, leading to reflection, leading to the emergence of new things to think about, words and other memes in our manifest image. It is this series of small steps, I am claiming, that both elevated words and other memes into our ontology, our manifest image, opening huge vistas to our inbuilt curiosity, and permitted the beginnings of top-down exploration of design space. I presented a simple version of this innovation in Consciousness Explained in 1991, where I imagined ancestors who, having acquired the habit of asking simple questions when they were stumped about something, discovered that sometimes they discovered the answers they were seeking even when no one else was there to hear them. They found themselves answering their own questions. They invented talking to themselves, which had some immediate and immediately appreciated benefits. How can talking to yourself help? Why isn't this like paying yourself for making yourself lunch? The air of paradox vanishes as soon as we recognize that we may know things in one part of our brain that cannot be accessed by other parts of the brain when needed. The practice of talking to yourself creates new channels of communication that may, on occasion, tease the hidden knowledge into the open. It seemed like a good idea at the time is a stock comic phrase in the aftermath of big mistakes, but far from being a badge of stupidity, this rueful phrase, if uttered truthfully, is a clear mark of intelligence, a thinker who can accurately recall what she actually thought and how she felt about it is more than halfway to taking a major step toward debugging her own thought processes so she won't fall in that trap again. The more subtle the error, the more valuable the habit of self-monitoring that is enabled by anyone who talks to themselves on a regular basis. The next time you try to solve a puzzle, consider indulging in a vocalized soliloquy. It's a good way to notice gaps in your thinking. It may be possible for animals without language to rack their brains for dormant clues, though there are scant signs of any such covert behavior. But in any case, our practice of explicit self-questioning has the further huge advantage of making our broodings more readily memorable, so that we can review them with hindsight. And once you have a habit of going into question-posing mode, all your R&D becomes much more top-down, using more directed search, and relying less on random variation and retention. Randomness, or what counts as randomness in evolution, the decoupling of the generation of candidates to test from the criteria of success, is not eliminated. Even the most sophisticated investigations often are expedited by deliberately random bouts of trial and error. But the search space can be squeezed by using information already acquired in other contexts to rule out large regions as unlikely or irrelevant, but only if the thinker can be reminded of it in a timely fashion. Talking to yourself, asking yourself questions, or even just the inner rehearsal of relevant words, keywords, is an efficient way of probing the networks of association attached to each word, reminding you of overlooked possibilities that are likely to be relevant to your current perplexity. Turing's invention of the digital computer can serve as our parade case of top-down intelligent design, and from what we can glean from the records of those heroic years, his path was no beeline to glory, but a meandering exploration of possibilities, sidetracks, false starts, adjusted goals, and plenty of serendipitous help from encounters with other thinkers thinking about other problems. The ideal of a conscious human mind is one in which all its knowledge is equa-accessible, always available when needed, never distorted, a pandemonium of experts ready to lend a timely hand. The Bayesian brain of an animal or child is well equipped to do some of this bottom-up canvassing for clues without benefit of more advanced thinking tools. But an adult mind can, on rare occasions, exert significant discipline on the crew, prioritizing, squelching wasteful competition, and organizing the search parties. In Herford's book on the evolution of language, he says at one point, "Non-human animals, at a certain evolved level, have rich mental lives, a kind of natural intelligence that allows them to negotiate their world well." The second part of the sentence is undeniable, but whether one has to have a rich mental life in the sense of a conscious life like ours in order to get around well in the world is not yet established. I have argued that the brain can be a Bayesian expectation generator without the affordances thereby tracked and exploited being owned, in effect. Whether non-human animals can think about thinking, or in any way go meta on their own mental states, is an empirical question that is not yet answered. And a rich mental life with no capacity to escalate reflexively is really not all that rich. How valuable is a compelling and accurate perception of, say, odors in a mind that cannot do much comparing and recalling and marveling and musing and noticing the results of these secondary and tertiary reactions? Note, I am not saying that non-human animals and human infants are not conscious. I have been postponing all discussion of consciousness. If consciousness itself is best seen as admitting of degrees, as I have argued and will defend again here in due course, then we can conceive of varieties of consciousness that are rich in some ways and not in others. Wealth is, in fact, a good concept to use to leverage this perspective. Consider the lucky chap who owns the land on which a pirate's cache of gold ingots is buried. In one sense, he is rich, but if he doesn't know about it or can't find it, and hence can't put his wealth to any use, his wealth is Pickwickian at best. Similarly, before the infant can track, notice, reflect on, compare, conjure up, recall, and anticipate the various differences in her world that are now available, in some sense, to her, we might better speak of potential riches. And if an animal can never occupy this reflexive perspective, the riches are not even potential. Showing your parrot lots of Nova documentaries will guarantee a vivid and detailed parade of information passing into its eyes and ears, but don't expect the parrot to get even a smattering of science education from the experience. I am still postponing a frontal attack on the puzzles of consciousness, so please note that I am not claiming or denying that tracking, noticing, reflecting on, and so on are necessarily conscious. I am claiming that these are very important response competences, in the absence of which consciousness, whatever it is, would offer little or nothing to the growing competence, and hence comprehension, of our ancestors. In Chapter 5, I argued that comprehension comes in degrees, and is in fact a product of competence, not an independent source of competence. Now we can see how this product is created. Basic affordances, genetically transmitted endowments of nature enhanced by Bayesian learning to capitalize on patterns in the environment, provide a wealth of competence for all locomotors from insects and worms to elephants and dolphins. Some of the more impressive of these competences are naturally taken as signs of comprehension, of sorts. The talents of a tool-using crow, or a tourist-wise grizzly bear in Yellowstone National Park, demonstrate levels of adaptiveness to unique situations that invite the verdict of understanding. One might even say that's what understanding is in these behavioral domains, not communicable theoretical knowledge, but deeply practical know-how. If that know-how is the limit of non-human comprehension, so far as we can tell, then what does human comprehension add to it? Not just the ability to communicate the know-how, or factual knowledge, to conspecifics, but the ability to treat whatever topic is under consideration as itself a thing to be examined, analyzed, inventoried, thanks to our capacity to represent it explicitly via words, diagrams, and other tools of self-stimulation. You can't do much thinking with your bare brain, but armed with these simple tools, an explosion of thoughtful exploration becomes available. As so often before, a competence designed by natural selection, now both genetic and mimetic, creates a gift, an uncomprehending competence, in this case the mastery of a language, which in turn provides ever-expanding levels of further competence. These are meta-competences, in which we use our thinking tools to think about not just food, shelter, doors, containers, dangers, and the other affordances of daily life, but also about thinking about food and shelter, and about thinking about thinking about food and shelter, as this sentence is demonstrating. Philosophy has been the chief academic home of meta-representation for several thousand years. It can be alternatively gripping and amusing to watch Plato and Socrates, and later Aristotle, struggling so cleverly with the quite novel task of trying to understand everything, including the very state of understanding itself. The reflective steps, examining the meaning of meaning, the understanding of understanding, using words to analyze words, eventually led to the recognition that, as Doug Hofstadter once put it, anything you can do, I can do meta. It doesn't always yield insight, and sometimes threatens to lose the participants in a hall of mirrors with no clear anchoring in the real world. But such are the excesses of a meme, a meta-meme, of tremendous power. The Age of Intelligent Design. This recursion, piling up stacks of meta-representations, triggered the MacCready explosion that has blossomed during the last 10 or 20,000 years, and which is still picking up speed. I suggested above that memes were very like software, and now I want to extend and sharpen that claim. Consider Java applets. You probably encounter them every day, almost certainly if you spend any time on the internet, but they are largely invisible by design. Java is the invention, by James Gosling and others in 1991, that is most responsible for giving the internet its versatility. It lets you download little programs, Java applets, from websites that permit you to solve crossword puzzles, play Sudoku, explore maps, enlarge photos, participate in adventure games with other players halfway around the world, and do a lot of serious computing, too. A website designer can write programs in the Java programming language without having to know whether the computers of the users who go to that website will be Macs or PCs or Linux machines, because a Java applet always runs on a JVM, a Java virtual machine, specifically designed to run on either a Mac or a PC or a Linux machine. The appropriate JVM is automatically downloaded to your computer and installed in a few seconds, and then the Java applet runs on the JVM like magic. You may have noticed Java updates being downloaded to your computer, or you may not have noticed. Ideally, you can forget about which JVM is installed on your computer and expect any website you go to will either have Java applets that already run on your JVM or will unobtrusively install the appropriate JVM update then and there. The JVM is the interface that compiles the Java code into code that will run on whatever hardware you are using. The Java slogan is WARA, write once, run anywhere, which means that design problems need to be solved just once. The excellence of this arrangement is easy to see when we compare it to the EVM, English virtual machine, installed in your brain's wetware. That is, you're an English speaker, or you couldn't be listening to this book. When I wrote this chapter, I had many problems of exposition and clarification to solve, but I didn't have to know any details at all about the neuroanatomy of the different brains that might end up reading it. I wrote it once. Well, I wrote many drafts, but published only one. And now it can run anywhere, on any brain that has an EVM. Some brains don't. The book will have to be translated into other languages if its effects are to be experienced by all. Otherwise, would-be listeners will just have to learn English. Think how easy this makes it for teachers, guides, informants, trainers, and also con artists, propagandists, and religious proselytizers to design a pitch that will have a good chance of installing still further memes in your brain, informing you, arming you with new tools, influencing you. I simply write down my invention, and when you listen to what I write, you download a new app to your necktop, as simple as that. My book, Intuition Pumps and Other Tools for Thinking, consists of 72 chapters, each presenting at least one thinking tool for you to download, along with advice on how to make and critique such thinking tools. Of course, that book presupposes a fair amount of prior general knowledge on many topics, so you have to have installed apps for those thinking tools as well. To pick a page at random, among the words I use without explanation are the following: daisy, starfish, anteater, olives, blob, tongue, inherited, childhood, category. If you don't happen to have any of those familiar tools in your kit, the page will be rough going. More difficult terms, ontology, Umwelt, manifest image, flicker fusion rate, mass term, and Sortal, are explained as I go along, new apps depending on other new apps depending on old apps. As Jackendoff has observed, many experiments with animals as subjects require that they first be trained to perform a very particular task, for a small food reward in most cases. If you want a cat or a monkey or a rat to press a lever whenever they see a square rather than a triangle, or when they hear beep rather than boop, it may take hundreds or even thousands of training trials to get the animal to be a reliable and attentive subject. When cognitive scientists want human subjects to perform the same task, a simple briefing in a language the subjects understand, including a promise of a payment to be received at the end of the session, along with a few practice trials, turns most human volunteers into flawless task executors for the duration of the experiment. In effect, people can download and execute a virtual machine with no need for trial and error or associative learning, taking on hundreds of roles on demand, swiftly and reliably. Thus, the neural plasticity and habits of attention required to turn us into relatively uncomprehending imitators provides the basis for acquiring language, which in turn grounds the cognitive virtuosity needed for hearing, understanding, and following instructions. Comprehension of language thus yields a much more general comprehension of behavior and of the whole world. But again, we mustn't exaggerate the effectiveness of this transfer that language makes possible. Some skills are harder to transmit than others, and some call for substantial rehearsal and mnemonic tricks, as noted in Chapter 6. The fanciful names and superimposed shapes for the constellations are among the surviving relics of these pioneering efforts at transfer of information. But we needn't assume that some clever astronomer devised the whole scheme as a self-conscious improvement in pedagogy. Probably, the associations were the result of gradually accreted traditions of storytelling, with their utility only slowly dawning on the participants, while second-rate, less memorable associations went extinct, failing to reproduce amidst the competition, until only the mnemonic champions remained. The parallel between Java applets and memes, or between digital computers and brains, is not exact, of course, as we have already seen. But let me underline a few points. It is true that a computer without an operating system, Windows, Mountain Lion, Linux, etc., is all but disabled. And it is true that you can't do much thinking with your bare brain for much the same reasons. But brains, unlike digital computers, don't have centralized hierarchical control with timing pulses, traffic cops to determine priorities, and so forth. So I can't just download my app to your brain and let it run. Control must be accomplished by negotiation, diplomacy, and even, on occasion, pleas, threats, or other emotional nudges. In general, I have to secure your attention, your cooperation, even, to some degree, your trust, because you are and ought to be vigilant against possible manipulation by other agents. Computers were initially designed to be obedient executors of every task offered to them, no questions asked. But with the growth of the Internet, the growing presence of malware designed to hijack computers for nefarious purposes, has obliged the designers of operating systems to include layer upon layer of protection, so that the default state today when any new software arrives is, "Don't run this code," without an express permission granted by the computer user or administrator. We human users are now the weakest link in the security, and ever more seductive phishing lures arrive almost daily, intelligently designed to win our trust. We can picture human culture accumulating at an ever swifter pace, since more directed search and more top-down problem-setting leads to more efficient problem-solving. Among the enabling innovations were such brilliant inventions as writing, arithmetic, money, clocks, and calendars, each contributing a novel and fecund system of representation that provided our manifest image with ever more portable, detachable, manipulable, recognizable, memorable things to do with, to exploit in our growing mastery of other things. These were, so far as anyone can tell, Darwinian inventions, that is, inventions without inventors or foresighted authors, more like bird wings than helicopter blades. The free-floating rationales of the features and structures of these inventions have been gradually captured, represented, and celebrated by later beneficiaries, retrospective reverse engineers who could explain to the world the particular utility of phonemic representation of words, zero as a number, hard to counterfeit coins, representing time with a line or a circle or a volume, using a fixed short cycle of names for days. All of these culturally transmitted artifacts, abstract or concrete, are unmistakably well-designed tools for thinking, but they were not the brain children of particular individual intelligent designers. This is also true of many, probably most, of the tools for other purposes that we have added to our toolkits over the millennia. In The Secret of Our Success, anthropologist Joseph Henrich explores in considerable detail excellent artifacts, such as kayaks, and argues that it is very unlikely that any one designer or fabricator could have been responsible for more than a few features, a few improvements over the artifacts that were his models. The lore that builds up around these artifacts is the product of retrospective theorizing, not original invention in most cases. It probably is composed mostly of byproducts of attempts to pass on the skills to apprentices, second-hand commentaries that may improve the understanding of the whole process, or, maybe, false consciousness, persuasive but mistaken theories of the topic. The adoption and use of new memes to solve problems typically generates greater comprehension in those who are doing the solving, but not always. Sometimes problem solvers stumble on solutions without noticing or while misunderstanding what they have done. Their triumphs spread, and often their reputations hitch a ride. If you have ever made a brilliant chess move and only appreciated its power retrospectively, and then kept that secret to yourself, you know the phenomenon. There is a general generous tendency to credit innovators with more prior comprehension than they actually deserve, and this helps perpetuate the myth of the godlike powers of our famous geniuses, and by extension, of all of us. Are we not the rational animals celebrated ever since Aristotle? The same illusions of comprehension that tend to infect our appreciation of the clever ploys of animals, and plants and bacteria as we have seen, distort our assessments of our fellow humans and of ourselves. One of the rules of thumb of a well-designed scam is that it should exploit our self-regard as clever detectors of fraud, giving us opportunities to prove the power of our skepticism before putting our judgment to the test. We are often shocked to discover how vulnerable we can be to scams and hoaxes, and in the very recognition of our victimhood on those occasions, we often commit the sin a second time, attributing more cleverness to the con artists who fooled us than they deserve. For, after all, their tricks are usually ancient and were field-tested and well-polished by generations of earlier hoaxers before being passed on. A classic instance is the old shell game, which dates back at least to ancient Greece. You are shown three walnut shells, or inverted cups, with a pea shown under one of them. The shells are then rapidly moved on the table. Now, where's the pea? Place your bets. You may have encountered a small group of people crowding around a shell manipulator, following the action and placing their bets on where the pea is. Appropriately cautious, you join the crowd, your hand carefully protecting the wallet in your pocket, and watch for a while. Some folks win, most folks lose, but in those cases you, clever you, can actually detect the misdirection, the sleight of hand, of the operator. After suitably scouting the whole scene, you get out your wallet and watch like a hawk for the surreptitious move you've practiced tracking. You make your bet and lose. How can that be? Simple. There are two sleight-of-hand moves, the one you've been allowed to detect and track, and the one the manipulator hasn't done yet, and it is, in fact, practically invisible to all but practiced magicians and con artists. Aside from you, the crowd is composed of accomplices, shills, who have put on a good show of being a little stupid, a little inattentive, too trusting, so that you can explain their losses and prepare to do otherwise when you enter the game. There is some genuine skill in the manipulator, who knows how to make the key move and knows how long to withhold it while waiting for you to put down your money. But the trick is new only to you. In more august social settings, the same idealized aura of comprehension tints our perception across agriculture, commerce, politics, music and art, religion, humor, in short, across all human civilization. The farmers with the largest harvests must know what they are doing, likewise the most profitable stockbrokers, the most popular musicians, the most re-elected politicians. While recognizing that dumb luck plays a hard-to-detect role, we follow the general rule of seeking the advice of the apparently successful. The models of classical economics, with their assumption of rational agents using the available information to optimize their market decisions, exhibit the undeniable attractions of the rationality assumption. By oversimplifying and idealizing actual transactions in the world, they turn messy human activity into a somewhat predictable, somewhat explicable set of phenomena, and they work quite well for many purposes. We may not be perfectly rational, but we are not so irrational. The explanation of the law of supply and demand, for instance, is transparent, since, in general, buyers will try to minimize expenses and sellers will try to maximize net receipts. The price for any commodity will rise and fall with its availability and desirability. It isn't a law of physics, it's a dictate of rational behavior. But you would be foolish indeed to bet against the law of supply and demand. If you have inside knowledge of something relevant that the market doesn't share, you may seem to cheat the law of supply and demand, but you are actually exploiting it. Any edge you gain will be dictated by the broad tendency of your victims to behave as the law prescribes. When we look at traditional accounts of cultural evolution, in the neutral sense of cultural change over time, the dominant theme is the economic model, as if all human cultural evolution took place near the ceiling of comprehension, and all involved objects valued for good reason. Cultural items on this model consist of goods, which are rationally acquired, maintained, repaired, and then bequeathed to the next generation, along with the know-how to preserve and enjoy them. We protect what we value. We transmit it to those whose interests we wish to enhance, and we invest in the infrastructure required to keep the goods in working order. This model doesn't work for cultural junk, the deplorable but infectious habits that spread in spite of our disvaluing them, or for stealthy cultural variants that reproduce without our taking notice of them. The new meaning of begs the question, for example. But it works quite well for the parts of human culture deemed treasures by at least some members of society. Grand opera is kept alive by patrons, who also endow music conservatories, and offer prizes for accomplished reproductions of the legacy items. Museums and libraries, universities and historic buildings, famous battlegrounds and monuments all require costly maintenance, and those who value these work hard to ensure that funds are secured to preserve them. Many people devote their lives to preserving traditional crafts and activities, weaving, embroidery, woodworking, blacksmithing, and Morris dancing, the Viennese waltz, dressage, and the Japanese tea ceremony. Religions devote a very large portion of the donations they collect from their members to preserving, heating, and furnishing their edifices, and paying their staffs, often with scant funds left over for helping and feeding the poor. When we peruse the heights of contemporary human culture, all the excellent artifacts, abstract and concrete, that maintain our health and security while freeing us from mindless toil and filling our newfound free time with all manner of art, music, entertainment, and adventure, we find a bounty of examples of intelligently designed entities. We know they were intelligently designed because we have witnessed and recorded the processes many times and have conversed with the designers, hearing their explanations and justifications, learning their techniques and goals, their aesthetic norms, and in many cases checking their proofs and documentations. We are indeed living in the age of intelligent design, and it goes back several millennia, as far back as we have documentation. The builders of the pyramids knew what they were doing and had articulated goals and plans, which they understood and executed with precision, organizing thousands of human workers in a process not at all like termite castle construction. It relied on top-down control and an impressive level of comprehension. That is not to say that the pyramid builders didn't rely on a massive amount of know-how, memes, that had been refined and optimized by relatively mindless differential replication over earlier millennia. Every generation has a legacy of accumulated knowledge, most of which has, by now, been practically confirmed in thousands of applications, including memorable failures by rebels who decided to buck tradition and try other methods and standards. While much of this hard-won knowledge has also been expressed, explained, analyzed, and rationalized in treatises on every imaginable topic, we shouldn't make the mistake of thinking that the authors of those treatises were often the inventors or designers of the principles and practices they teach. In general, from Aristotle's day to the present, the explanations and justifications of our storehouse of general knowledge are a kind of Whig history, written by the victors, triumphantly explaining the discoveries and passing over the costly mistakes and misguided searches. If we want a clear idea of intelligent design, we need to resist the retrospective myth-making and give some attention to the history of the failures and to all the second-rate design we can identify around us. For one thing, it heightens our appreciation of the best work. For instance, my understanding of how magnificent great art is has been amplified by hours spent in second-rank art museums in Europe, where one can see hundreds of minor works in the styles and with the same aspirations as Raphael and Rembrandt and Rubens and Rodin, and see immediately how lifeless and unbalanced most of them are compared with the masterpieces. The world's music libraries contain the scores of thousands of classical symphonies that will probably never be played again for good reason. There are perhaps a few unheralded masterpieces among the lackluster compositions, but few musicians are eager to engage in the mind-deadening task of prospecting for them. This huge backlog of nearly invisible cultural accumulation plays a role not unlike that of all the organisms in all the species who died childless, but whose competition tested the mettle of those whose descendants live on today. Haydn and Mozart and Beethoven had to grow their talents in a world that included lots of slightly less talented, or maybe just unlucky, composers. In the course of all this deliberate husbandry of domesticated memes, there is a lot of conscious, conscientious decision-making, and the economic model does about as well accounting for the patterns of decisions in these areas as it does in more commercial areas. The law of supply and demand governs the future trajectories of both dressage academies and lollipop makers. But even in the most bureaucratic and rationalized of institutions, there are patterns of change, of evolution, that resist capture by the economic model, that appear as mere noise or happenstance. Some of this obstreperous variation is, no doubt, sheer noise, as good as random, but much of it is driven not by the rational pressures of the marketplace, but by arms races of Darwinian mimetic evolution. There is an incessant competition among memes for replication, and accounting for the biases that fuel the competition requires descending from the ceiling of pure rationality and looking at the middle ground, where semi-comprehending agents engage in semi-well-designed projects that generate a host of foibles, fresh new targets to attract foible exploiters. Equally, semi-comprehending agents who sense, with varying degrees of accuracy, that their interests will be well served by adopting memes, adapting memes, revising memes designed by a mixture now of natural selection and intelligent design, to take advantage of the weaknesses they seem to detect in their quarry. These arms races are the latest wave in the creative arms races that have driven genetic evolution for 3 billion years, and they differ mainly in involving a significant degree of comprehension to lubricate and accelerate the innovations and reactions. This comprehension is overwhelmingly the product of language and other media of communication. Adding these varieties of information exchange to the scene changes the selective environment in revolutionary ways. Standard Darwinian evolution by natural selection, lacking all foresight, rolls through populations that also lack foresight. The survivors are lucky to happen to be better equipped for the new conditions than the rest of their generation, and there is little or no advance warning of new risks and opportunities. If an individual wildebeest hits on a novel evasive move that saves it from predation, there is no swift way for all the other wildebeests in the herd to adopt it, and word of it certainly can't be spread to other herds across the savannas. With us, there are well-developed traditions of gathering and passing along new advice as soon as it becomes available, whether it is good or bad advice. All the fables and folktales and nostrums, all the worldly wisdom you acquired at mother's knee, is supplemented by gossip and rumor, and further enhanced thanks to writing, printing, and all the high-tech media of today. This speeds up and intensifies the arms races and complicates them with subplots and side bets as people furnish their imaginations with all the information and use it to dream up variations. It is harder today to find marks for the Nigerian prince scam than it was 20 years ago, because it is so well known that it can be a reliable topic for humor. Why, you may wonder, does the scam survive? And why do the scammers persist in using the same old dubious tale of a Nigerian prince who wants to transfer a fortune and needs your help? Because the scammers don't want to waste their time and effort on smart people. The cost of sending out millions of initial email lures is trivial compared to the cost, in time and effort, of reeling in a sucker who has bitten on it. You can't afford to attract too many bites. Most potential victims who start down that path will soon get suspicious and easily discover the truth, and then back out without making any down payments. And some may even enjoy playing the scammers for as long as possible. To minimize the cost of reeling in fish that will shake off the hook before being landed, the initial lure is designed to be so preposterous that only a very dull, sheltered, credulous person would seriously engage it. In short, there is a skeptic filter built into the scam, so that effort can be concentrated on the most vulnerable victims. Political advisors and advertisers, trend analyzers, and speculators aggressively observe and perturb the memosphere, prospecting for new moves, new opportunities, new cracks in the armor of skepticism and caution that all but the most naive people use to protect themselves. Everybody wants to go viral with their pet messages while finding new ways of ignoring the surfeit of attention grabbers that assault them. This fluidity of information transmission in human culture and its use in combating, discrediting, discarding, but also revising, improving, adapting, and spreading new memes pushes Darwinian meme evolution into the background. Have I just admitted that memetics cannot be a valuable theoretical tool in modeling today's and tomorrow's cultural evolution? Consider again the claim by Steven Pinker quoted in Chapter 11. The striking features of cultural products, namely their ingenuity, beauty, and truth, analogous to organisms' complex adaptive design, come from the mental computations that direct, that is, invent, the mutations, and that acquire, that is, understand, the characteristics. This is close to the truth about some cultural products, but, as we have seen, by insisting that invention and understanding are the sole phenomena at work, Pinker restricts our attention to cultural treasures only, and exaggerates the role of intelligent design in creating these. Moreover, Pinker underestimates the distortion that is built into our linguistic practices, a demand for reasons that outstrips our ability to feed it. When we acquire our mother tongues, we are initiated into the space of reasons, not free-floating rationales anymore, but anchored rationales, represented reasons we own up to and endorse, our answers to all the why questions. The transition is awkward because we don't always have good answers, but that doesn't stop us from playing the game. Why do you build your boats this way? Because that's the way we've always built them. But why is that a good reason? Because it just is. The normativity of reason giving imposes itself even when we are at a loss for an answer. There is an obligation to have reasons that you can give for your behavior. This is the intentional stance in action, always presuming rationality. There must be a good reason, or we wouldn't be doing it this way. Faced with this demand, the temptation, often succumbed to, is to pick a likely reason out of thin air and advance it with a knowing air, thereby giving birth to a handy bit of ideology that might even be right. If no plausible reasons occur to us, the wisdom of our ancestors can be wrung in when necessary. They knew the reasons, and we are grateful that they taught us, even though they didn't tell us why. It's a short step from here to, God works in mysterious ways. Infants, before they have language, must be trained much as you would train a dog. Don't touch. No. Come. Stop that. That's good. Now do it again. Parents don't presume that the infants will understand why. They're just babies. But as they begin to speak, we begin to give them reasons. Don't touch, hot. Don't touch, dirty. Eat, it's good for you. Obedience, even blind obedience, is useful as a basis. There will be time for explaining and arguing later. Because I said so is an important stage. And then, as we grow up, we are introduced to the norms of human society, which include preeminently the presumption of rationality in each other, especially in adults, but not, of course, in our domesticated animals. A cowpony exhibiting insight into the tasks she executes with her rider delights and surprises us. How clever! Sheepdogs are thrilling examples, and they are thrilling because they are exceptional. We don't hold animals up to the standards we hold for each other. This is an ineliminable feature of language use. The presumption of comprehension is the default, so much so that when it is violated, we can become disoriented. In a foreign land, you need to ask directions and optimistically try your native tongue, just in case you're speaking to somebody who happens to know it. The native smiles and listens, nodding and bright-eyed, so you carry on confidently. And when you stop, your interlocutor reveals he hasn't understood a word. Bump! What a letdown. We lead our daily lives bathed in the presumption of understanding, in the strangers we encounter as well as our family and friends. We expect people to expect us to have reasons, reasons we can express, for whatever it is we are trying to do, and we effortlessly make up reasons, often without realizing it, when a query catches us without a pre-thought answer. It is against this background that memetics look so wrong-headed, so subversive, as Pinker says. We are the reasoners. We are the intelligent designers. We are the explainers of everything. It is an affront to suggest that some of our brainstorms are just that. Cerebral disturbances caused by invading memes duking it out for dominance. We are in charge. And we are in charge to a gratifying degree. That is the triumph of the memes invasion. It has turned our brains into minds, our minds, capable of accepting and rejecting the ideas we encounter, discarding or developing them for reasons we can usually express thanks to the apps installed in our necktops. But we don't always have reasons, and that is one thing that distinguishes us from the imaginable but impossible rational agents of GOFAI, the ultimate dream of intelligent design. In such knowledge systems, reasons are represented all the way down, in the sense that all thinking is seen as theorem proving. When a GOFAI tells you something, you can, in principle, always demand a reason, and it should be forthcoming, since whatever the GOFAI told you had to have been generated by rational inference from its database of axioms. It can show you the proof, and you can criticize it, step by step, if you wish. The advent of deep learning and Bayesian methods has been viewed with mixed emotions by many in cognitive science. Why? The fact that these new cognitive fabrics work so well is astonishing and delightful, and their applications are going to sweep the world. But although they will give us great answers to hard questions like never before, they won't be able to tell us why. They will be oracles who cannot engage in the game of reason-giving. More on this in the last chapter. Pinker, Wilde, Edison, and Frankenstein. The first duty in life is to be as artificial as possible. Oscar Wilde. In a typically lucid commentary on my Harvard Mind-Brain-Behavior lectures of 2009, Steven Pinker expanded his critique of memes. Design without a designer is crucial for biological evolution, but it is perverse for cultural evolution. There really is a designer, the human brain, and there's nothing mystical or mysterious about saying that. Pinker and I agree, of course, about biological, genetic, evolution being design without a designer, and we agree that the human brain's powers as a designer depend on its having been designed, until very recently, without a designer. What I have been arguing, however, is that much of this R&D is, and must be, mimetic, not genetic, evolution. Long before we had designer brains, we had brains that were requiring design without a designer, in the form of invading memes. But there is more explanatory work for memetics to do even once we are well into the age of intelligent design. In his commentary, Pinker introduces two good examples. The origin of the word acne, which descended from an uncorrected misprint of the Greek word acme, meaning pinnacle, which he contrasted with the coining of the term palimony, introduced by a stroke of creation or insight or wit, a portmanteau combination of pal and alimony. But we don't know that this is true. The term was first used in public by the divorce attorney Marvin Mitchelson in 1977, when his client, Michelle Triola Marvin, filed an unsuccessful suit against the actor Lee Marvin, to whom she had not been legally wed. Wikipedia, subverbo palimony. But we don't know whether Mitchelson's creation was a stroke of wit or the result of a tedious generation of variations. Alimony, balimony, calimony, dalimony, maybe. Galimony, ho-hum, palimony, hey, I can use that. I know two inveterate punsters who have confessed to me that this is what they do obsessively with almost every phrase they hear, discarding 99% and more of what they swiftly consider. Not very intelligent design with its laborious and promiscuous semi-directed search, or is it? A curious feature of our appreciation of wit or genius is that we prefer not to know how it is done. We think of Oscar Wilde as a great wit. It would no doubt diminish his reputation considerably if we learned that he lay awake most nights for hours, obsessively musing, "Now what would I reply if somebody asked me, and what might my pithy opinion be of?" Suppose we learned that he patiently worked out and polished several dozen bons mots per night, ingeniously indexing them in his memory, all freshly canned, and, if the occasion should arise, ready to unleash without skipping a beat, for brevity is indeed the soul of wit. They would still be his witticisms, and their funniness would depend, as the Polish comedian said, on timing. Timing is important for almost any intelligent act, which is why it is intelligent to anticipate and pre-solve problems wherever possible. Wilde's brute force witticism production scheme might disappoint us, but it draws attention to the fact that all intelligent responses depend on costly R&D, and it doesn't make much difference how the work is distributed in time, so long as the effects are timely. Thomas Alva Edison's famous line about genius being 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration provokes in many people the unkind thought that this may be true of Edison and a few other dogged but dim-witted inventors, but real genius reverses the percentages, just as Picasso boasted. This attitude clouds our insight into the relationship between creativity and consciousness, one of the distortions of Cartesian gravity, which we are beginning to feel ever more strongly as we approach consciousness. We want our minds to be inspired and uncanny, and we tend to view attempts to dissect these, our most precious gifts, as impertinent assaults, and Philistine to boot. Anybody who is foolish enough to think our minds are all just so much neural machinery must have a pathetically impoverished acquaintance with the magic of our minds. Lee Siegel, in his remarkable book on Indian street magic, includes a passage I have often quoted. "I'm writing a book on magic," I explain, and I'm asked, "Real magic?" By real magic, people mean miracles, thaumaturgical acts, and supernatural powers. "No," I answer, "conjuring tricks, not real magic." Real magic, in other words, refers to the magic that is not real, while the magic that is real, that can actually be done, is not real magic. Even many neuroscientists, committed naturalists, tend to flinch when they start closing in on how the neural machinery works its wonders, and a tempting bit of modesty is to deny that they are even trying to tackle the hard problem, leaving the real magic of consciousness as a cosmic mystery for future centuries to track down, with the help of currently unimaginable revolutions in physics. Those who think this way ought to contemplate a trade secret divulged by one of the best stage magicians, Jamie Ian Swiss. No one would ever think that we would ever work this hard to fool you. That's a secret and a method of magic. If you don't even try to imagine how it might be done with a mountain of drudge work, you'll be permanently mystified. I mentioned in Chapter 2 that magicians have no shame. Neither do brains. Since there is no such thing as real magic, whatever trajectory a genius mind manages to pursue must ultimately be accounted for in the cascade of cranes that have been designed and erected over the last few billion years. One way or another, the mind was lifted, by good design, into a region of design space from which its further forays were admirably swift and effective. Whether the inspiration is 1% or 99%, it must be a feature of a vehicle for exploring design space that has its own non-supernatural R&D history, typically an unfathomable combination of genes, education, life experience, mentoring, and who knows what else? Diet, the chance overhearing of a strain of music, emotional imbalances, temporary or permanent, and yes, sometimes, insanity. Mental illness or pathology that has fortuitous benefits, for the art world if not the artist. When we try to figure out how much of the invention we can attribute to the creativity of the individual artist, we get at least a rough idea by imagining the particular region of design space traversed to arrive at the final product. A thought experiment focuses the issue. Suppose Dr. Frankenstein designs and constructs a monster, Spakeshear, that thereupon sits up and writes out a play, Spamlet. Who is the author of Spamlet? First, let's take note of what I claim to be irrelevant in this thought experiment. I haven't said whether Spakeshear is a robot constructed out of metal and silicon chips, or constructed out of human tissues, or cells, or proteins, or amino acids, or carbon atoms. As long as the design works, and the construction was carried out by Dr. Frankenstein, it makes no difference what the materials are. It might well turn out that the only way to build a robot small enough and fast enough and energy efficient enough to sit on a stool and type out a play is to construct it from artificial cells filled with beautifully crafted motor proteins and other carbon-based nanorobots. That is an interesting technical and scientific question, but not of concern here. For exactly the same reason, if Spakeshear is a metal and silicon robot, it may be allowed to be larger than a galaxy, if that's what it takes to get the requisite complication into its program. And we'll just have to repeal the speed limit for light for the sake of our thought experiment. Since such technical constraints are commonly declared to be off-limits in these thought experiments, so be it. If Dr. Frankenstein chooses to make his AI robot out of proteins and the like, that's his business. If his robot is cross-fertile with normal human beings, and hence capable of creating what is arguably a new species by giving birth to a child, that is fascinating. But what we will be concerned with is Spakeshear's purported brainchild, Spamlet. Back to our question. Who is the author of Spamlet? In order to grasp on this question, we need to look inside and see what happens in Spakeshear. At one extreme, we find inside a file, if Spakeshear is a robot with a computer memory, or a memorized version of Spamlet, all loaded and ready to run. In such an extreme case, Dr. Frankenstein is surely the author of Spamlet, using his intermediate creation, Spakeshear, as a mere storage and delivery device. A particularly fancy word processor. All the R&D work was done earlier and copied to Spakeshear by one means or another. We can visualize this more clearly by imagining a subspace of design space, which I call the Library of Babel, after Jorge Luis Borges' classic short story by that name. Borges invites us to imagine a warehouse filled with books that appears to its inhabitants to be infinite. They eventually decide that it is not, but it might as well be, for it seems that on its shelves, in no order, alas, are all the possible books. Now we are ready to return to that needle in a haystack, Spamlet, and consider how the trajectory to this particular place in the Library of Babel was traversed in actual history. If we find that the whole journey was completed by the time Spakeshear's memory was constructed and filled with information, we know that Spakeshear played no role in the search. Working backward, if we find that Spakeshear's only role was running the stored text through a spell checker before using it to guide its typing motions, we will be unimpressed by claims of Spakeshearian authorship. This is a measurable but vanishingly small part of the total R&D. There is a sizable galaxy of near-twin texts of Spamlet. Roughly 100 million different minor mutants have but a single uncorrected typo in them. And if we expand our horizon to include one typo per page, we have begun to enter the land of vast numbers of variations on the theme. Working back a little further, once we graduate from typos to thinkos, we have begun to enter the land of serious authorship, as contrasted with mere copy editing. The relative triviality of copy editing, and yet its unignorable importance in shaping the final product, gets well represented in terms of our metaphor of design space, where every little bit of lifting counts for something, and sometimes a little bit of lifting moves you to a whole new trajectory. As usual, we may quote Ludwig Mies van der Rohe at this juncture, "God is in the details." Now let's turn the knobs on our thought experiment, as Douglas Hofstadter has recommended, and look at the other extreme, in which Dr. Frankenstein leaves most of the work to Spakeshear. The most realistic scenario would be that Spakeshear has been equipped by Dr. Frankenstein with a virtual past, a lifetime stock of pseudo-memories of experiences on which to draw while responding to its Frankenstein-installed obsessive desire to write a play. Among those pseudo-memories, we may suppose, are many evenings at the theater or reading books, but also some unrequited loves, some shocking close calls, some shameful betrayals, and the like. Now, what happens? Perhaps some scrap of a human interest story on the news will be the catalyst that spurs Spakeshear into a frenzy of generate and test, ransacking its memory for useful tidbits and themes, transforming, transposing, morphing what it finds, jiggling the pieces into temporary hopeful structures that compete for completion, most of them dismantled by the corrosive processes of criticism that expose useful bits now and then, and so forth. All this multi-leveled search would be somewhat guided by multi-level, internally generated evaluations, including evaluation of the evaluation, of the evaluation functions as a response to evaluation of the products of the ongoing searches. Now, if the amazing Dr. Frankenstein had actually anticipated all this activity down to its finest grain at the most turbulent and chaotic level and had hand-designed Spakeshear's virtual past and all its search machinery to yield just this product, Spamlet, then Dr. Frankenstein would be once again the author of Spamlet, but also, in a word, God. Such vast foreknowledge would be simply miraculous. Restoring a smidgen of realism to our fantasy, we can set the knobs at a rather less extreme position, and assume that Dr. Frankenstein was unable to foresee all this in detail, but rather he delegated to Spakeshear most of the hard work of completing the trajectory in design space to a literary work to be determined by later R&D occurring within Spakeshear itself. We have now arrived by this simple turn of the knob in the neighborhood of reality. For we already have actual examples of impressive artificial authors that vastly outstrip the foresight of their own creators. Nobody has yet created an artificial playwright worth serious attention, but an artificial chess player, IBM's Deep Blue, and an artificial composer, David Cope's EMI, have both achieved results that are, in some respects, equal to the best that human creative genius can muster. We can adapt the thought experiment of Spakeshear's trajectory through design space to analyze other realms of human creativity and discovery. The refinement of the text of Spamlet can be precisely measured in some dimensions because all the possible variants reside in Borges's Library of Babel, and their differences, typos and thinkos and boring digressionos, can be identified and evaluated. We can identify culpable plagiarism and laudable inspiration, though there is no bright line separating these realms. Now that we have 3D printers to play with, we have a host of formats for representing any three-dimensional object, a clothespin, an electric can opener, a Rodin sculpture, a Stradivarius violin, as a digital file that can be compared to its variants. When Picasso sees a bicycle seat and handlebars as just what he needs to make a bull's head, he is not really plagiarizing, but he is helping himself to some carefully designed and optimized shape and materials for his own purposes, an artistic practice honored with its own term, objets trouvés. Thus all concrete inventions and appropriations, tools, instruments, art objects, machines, can be placed uniquely in a multidimensional space, the library of objects, if you like, and their discovery or invention lineages mapped, rather like the lineages in the Tree of Life, but with a lot of anastomoses. How similar must two things be, in which dimensions, to count as design worth protecting by patent or copyright? Don't expect there to be easy objective answers to such questions. Abstract inventions particularly defy being put in alphabetical order in any space of any particular dimensionality. A refreshing note for all anti-reductionists to savor. But the conveying of abstract inventions from mind to mind still relies on some combination of words and images or other recordable, transmissible representations. Turing's brilliant fable image of a machine chugging along on a paper tape, reading and erasing, or not, a mark and then moving on, is not an optional feature of his invention. This gives us another perspective on the law's requirement that patents be of demonstrated utility, and that a musical innovation must have some fixed expression to be copyrightable. The multidimensional design space in which the Tree of Life has grown has now generated a daughter design space for our brain children, and it has more dimensions and more possibilities than its parent, and we are, so far, the only species that can explore it. Steven Pinker is right that the human brain really is a designer, but this should be seen not as an alternative to the mimetic approach, but as a continuation of the mimetic approach into the age of gradually de-Darwinizing semi-intelligent design. Our traditional vision of genius portrays it as completely unlike natural selection in its creative powers, and it is no accident that genius is often seen as divine, supernatural, godlike. After all, we created God in our own manifest image, a natural overextension of the intentional stance into the cosmos. Pinker, a stalwart and imaginative Darwinian and naturalist, has done what he can to launder the mystery out of our conception of the mind, and has been roundly cudgeled for his intrepid Darwinian forays into the humanities. But here, Cartesian gravity deflects him slightly from the course that will take us all the way from bacteria to Bach. Bach has a landmark of intelligent design. It is in perfect accordance with the scheme of nature, as worked out by natural selection, that matter excreted to free the system from superfluous or injurious substances should be utilized for other highly useful purposes. Charles Darwin, 1862. Judging a poem is like judging a pudding or a machine. One demands that it work. It is only because an artifact works that we infer the intention of an artificer. W. Wimsatt and M. Beardsley, 1954. Turing, Picasso, Einstein, Shakespeare, all are excellent examples of intelligent designers. But I want to look more closely at Johann Sebastian Bach, 1685 to 1750, who combines the virtues of intelligent designers in a particularly informative way. On the one hand, he was born into a musical family. His father and uncles were all professional musicians of note, and of his 20 children, 4 who survived to adulthood were composers or musicians of note. So there is a strong likelihood that he had an unusually strong dose of genes for music. We mustn't ignore the role of culture, however, in explaining how music runs in families. Being raised in a musical family, whatever your genes are, means you will be surrounded by music, encouraged to participate in the family's musical life, and be imbued with the importance of music. On the other hand, he supplemented his God-given musical competence with extensive study. He was an expert on counterpoint and harmony, and a broadly informed student of earlier composers whose works he analyzed in depth. He was also something of an 18th-century technocrat, an organist, and also an expert on the design, repair, and maintenance of those magnificent mechanical marvels, honored ancestors of today's electronic synthesizers. Compare Bach to another truly great composer, Irving Berlin, who couldn't read music, could play the piano in only one key, F-sharp, so he could play almost everything on the black keys, and had to rely on a musical secretary to write down and harmonize his great melodies. He apparently exerted very strict control over the harmonizations written down by his assistant, but did it all by ear with no knowledge of harmony theory. Once he became rich and famous, very early in his career, he had a special piano built with a sliding keyboard, so he could keep playing in F-sharp while rolling the keyboard into position to transpose into other keys. Could such an unschooled composer be brilliant? Absolutely. Among his ardent admirers as a composer were Cole Porter and George Gershwin, both highly trained musicians. Gershwin, no slouch himself, called Berlin the greatest songwriter that has ever lived. Berlin is not by any means the only great composer who couldn't read music. The Beatles are probably the most notable example, with at least several dozen songs that will go on to inspire covers and adaptations and homages across the musical spectrum from hip-hop to string quartets. Leonard Bernstein, the Harvard-educated, classically trained composer and symphony conductor, published an essay in 1955 with the amusing title, "Why Don't You Run Upstairs and Write a Nice Gershwin Song?" in which he recounted his failed attempt, in collaboration with another sophisticated musical friend, to write a hit Tin Pan Alley song. Nobody was more appreciative of the gulf between technical expertise and success, both financial and musical, than Bernstein, who ended his essay with a wistful confession, "It's just that it would be nice to hear someone accidentally whistle something of mine somewhere, just once." 2 years later, his wish came true, with West Side Story. But Bernstein, for all his genius, was no overnight sensation, and neither, for that matter, was Bach. In spite of Bach's prodigious output as a composer, at the time of his death, he was known mainly as a great organist. And it was roughly 50 years after his death when other composers, critics, and musicians began to secure his fame and drive his memes to fixation in the history of Western music. The failure of Bach's compositions to spread like wildfire was not due to a lack of interest on Bach's part in securing their ready replication. He was, in fact, a pioneer in the fine art of borrowing success from tradition. In Leipzig, he was Kapellmeister, music director of the Thomas Church and other churches in Leipzig, for over 25 years until his death in 1750. One of his duties was to compose and perform cantatas, elaborate songs for choir and soloists, accompanied by a chamber orchestra or sometimes just an organ. He wrote hundreds of these, one for each Sunday in the church calendar, each tailored to fit the liturgy and ceremony of the occasion. He is reported to have composed 5 full-year cycles, Jahrgänge, of which 3 still exist, so roughly 100 of his cantatas are apparently lost forever. Beginning in his second year, he adopted the policy of basing each cantata on a chorale, a pre-existing Lutheran hymn that would be familiar to most of the congregation. These melodies had proven themselves over the decades or centuries, demonstrating by their survival that they were well adapted to the ears and minds of their hosts. Thus, Bach gave himself a fine head start in the project of coming up with musical memes that would have staying power, if not go viral. If you were faced with the task of composing 50 hummable theme songs a year, you might follow his lead by helping yourself to Amazing Grace, I've Been Working on the Railroad, Jingle Bells, composed by James Lord Pierpont, O Susanna, and Way Down Upon the Suwannee River, composed by Stephen Foster, and You Are My Sunshine, composed by Jimmy Davis. Bach took the chorale melody as the skeleton, and then built a breathtakingly beautiful musical body to bring it new life. He was the Dr. Frankenstein of musical reincarnation. No doubt some music lovers, reading these juxtaposed paragraphs on Bach, Bernstein, Berlin, and the Beatles, will be tempted to declare their judgment confirmed. Those who dare dabble in memes are appalling Philistines, unable to tell quality from quantity. In fact, I hope I have succeeded in provoking that sentiment precisely in order to unpack it and send it packing. There need be no conflict at all between the objective scientific study of culture, high and low, on the one hand, and the articulation of aesthetic judgments on the other. Mimeticists are not denied entry to the arena of critical judgment just because they insist on trying to measure, predict, and explain the differential reproduction of memes. To balance the equation, those in the arts and humanities who tend to regard bestsellers, graphic novels, and platinum albums as ipso facto artistic trash need to jettison that prejudice and learn to discern the considerable interplay between quality and quantity across the spectrum of the arts. I might add that scientists who disdain all attempts to explain science to the general public need to take on board much the same advice. I have, on several occasions, polled large audiences of scientists to confirm that they were inspired to become scientists by reading the works of Stephen Hawking, E.O. Wilson, Richard Dawkins, Douglas Hofstadter, Steven Pinker, and other excellent communicators of science. It is a shame, really, that the arts and humanities have not managed to generate many great counterpart explainer-celebrators from their ranks. Leonard Bernstein was one, and Sir Kenneth Clarke was another, but that was half a century ago. Who since then has even tried to do work of sufficient quality to reach an audience of large quantity? Wynton Marsalis and Stephen Greenblatt come to mind. Perhaps there would be less hand-wringing about the forlorn plight of the arts and humanities if more intelligent design in those fields had been devoted to spreading the word more widely. It is an objective cultural fact worth discovering that today more people can hum White Christmas than Jesu Joy of Man's Desiring. Pointing in the other direction is the fact that Brahms was not just wildly popular during his lifetime, but also the first famous recording artist. A colleague of Edison made a cylinder recording of him playing a portion of his first Hungarian dance in 1889. Quantity isn't to be equated with quality, but success and propagation is, in the end, as necessary for memes, however excellent, as it is for organisms. Most organisms leave no issue, and most published books have readerships in the dozens, not thousands, before going out of print for good. Even the greatest works of genius must still pass the test of differential replication. Today, Herman Melville's Moby Dick is rightly regarded as one of the greatest novels in the English language, yet it went out of print in his lifetime and was all but forgotten until 1919, when the centenary of Melville's birth occasioned some favorable retrospective criticism. This was followed by two film versions, departing radically from the novel, and the Chicago edition of 1930, with the unforgettable Rockwell Kent woodcut illustrations. This led finally to the Modern Library Giant edition of 1943, which included the brilliant Kent illustrations. Thereafter, the immortality of Moby Dick was assured. Perhaps, as some critics have proposed, the truly greatest works of art always travel well through time and space, and somehow find a way of striking a chord in people's hearts, no matter how removed they are from the circumstances of the creation of the work. Or perhaps not. The processes by which neglected masterpieces get resurrected often include striking juxtapositions of features that have little to do with the excellences thoughtfully designed by their authors, and more to do with striking a chord in the serendipitous encounters that ensue. So even if our brains are, at their best, intelligent designers, explaining the dominant patterns in culture requires divorcing the circumstances of creation from the vicissitudes of survival. In Chapter 2, a question was posed and postponed. Why have there been so few famous female geniuses? Is it genes or memes or a mixture of both? Our present vantage point suggests that the answer will lie more in features of culture than in cortex, but not by supporting the discredited mantra from the 1960s, boys and girls are biologically the same. All differences are due to socialization and other cultural pressures. That is politically correct nonsense. Male and female brains are not exactly alike. How could they be, given the differences in paternal and maternal biological roles? There are dozens of reliably detectable differences of neuroanatomy, hormonal balance, and other physiological signs, and their genetic sources are not in doubt. Moreover, these physical differences issue in differences in cognitive and emotional competence and style that are statistically significant. But there is plenty of variation between women and between men, so some women excel at tasks that mostly men excel at, and vice versa. Besides, we're asking what explains the fame of more male than female intelligent designers, and that property is, as we have just noted, quite loosely and unreliably associated with the quality of the designer's mind. What makes a song or a joke go viral, and what makes a person's name and reputation go viral, are about equally inscrutable, with plenty of worthy candidates of all kinds for natural selection to pick, quite blindly, for amplification. That doesn't mean that it is sheer luck that determines who gets famous. The imbalance between men and women virtually guarantees that this cannot be the case. Could have a gene for luck that women lack? Not a chance. So there must be some imbalance in the average starting lines, with men getting more chances for stardom than women in the famous genius crapshoot. For past centuries, the explanation for this is obvious. For millennia, very few women ever got a chance to develop their talents. Even in recent years, moreover, there are lots of anecdotes about female scientists. For instance, who deserved most of the credit for the discoveries and proofs that bestowed fame on their male colleagues? And now that women are finally beginning to make large inroads in male-dominated fields, science is shifting to ever larger teams of researchers, where the opportunities to stand out are curtailed by the administrative demands of the projects. The same is true in other domains of intelligent design. Where are the Babbages and Edisons and Watts of today? Working with teams at Google and Apple and Amazon, legendary among their colleagues, perhaps, but living in relative anonymity in the wider world. As we shall see in Chapter 15, the heroic age of intelligent design is beginning to wane just when its would-be heroines are finally getting to prove their powers. The evolution of the selective environment for human culture. At the dawn of human culture, ancestors hosted beneficial memes with no more understanding than they had for their genetically transmitted instincts. They didn't need understanding to acquire the new competences, and they didn't gain much understanding from having the new competences. The significant difference that culture made in the early days was just that these culture-born ways of behaving could be reshaped during a single generation of hosts and transmitted between non-relatives and acquired throughout life, not just at birth. As memes accumulated and became more and more effective at inhabiting their hosts, becoming more helpful or less of a hindrance, or else subjugating their hosts for their own benefit, the manifest image became populated with more and more affordances, more and more opportunities to track, more and more things to do things with, more and more things, words, to use as tools to help keep track of things, and so forth. Some memes were tools, some were toys, some were distractions, some were crippling parasites. They all depended on cultural replication to survive. This competitive environment created evolutionary arms races with the same inevitable burgeoning of technology and counter-technology found in human warfare. Lies and threats and bluffs and probes and tests, like the shibboleth test, for instance, which could be used as a sort of linguistic passport. Can you pronounce shibboleth correctly? If you can't, you're not one of us. Systems of best practices, bartering, promising, mutual informing, warning before striking, for instance, could prove themselves or, at any rate, go to fixation locally, creating traditions that were known by all and known to be known by all, making them part of the more or less fixed behavioral environment in which plans could be made, discussed, accepted, or rejected. How much of this could be accomplished without full-fledged grammatical language is anyone's guess at present. But without getting all the elements in proper order of historical appearance, we can still see how a gradual, growing sophistication of behavior could arise by small innovations, adjustments, and refinements, building excellently designed cultural habits and institutions without much help from intelligent design. First learning, then adaptations for learning. Once the value of swift learning was revealed by the relative success of the swifter learners, ways of accelerating the process could evolve, both culturally and genetically. One of the most valuable innovations was the practice of putting marks in the environment to take a load off personal memory, one of the first forays of the extended mind. Marks then evolved into number systems and written languages, which enhanced the power of discursive teaching, and within a few millennia we have Socrates and Plato and Aristotle talking about talking, thinking about thinking, imagining republics, theorizing about tragedy and comedy. The age of intelligent design is in full swing. Merely Skinnerian and Popperian creatures couldn't keep up with Gregorian creatures, their minds overflowing with new tools for making ever swifter and more accurate assessments of the complex environment confronting them. Brute force trial and error would no longer suffice. You had to comprehend to compete. Now we live in a world where memes without clear authors still go viral, such as fads and fashions, pronunciation shifts and buzzwords. But they have to compete with memetically engineered inventions, created with foresight and purpose by professional memesmiths who play a significant role in contemporary society as authors, artists, composers, reporters, commentators, advertisers, teachers, critics, historians, speechwriters. Pinker is right that the successful brain children of these human beings are intelligently designed, without mystery, but they swim in an ocean of semi-intelligently designed, hemi-semi-demi-intelligently designed, and evolutionarily designed competitors, all still dependent on getting into new human brains to continue their lineages. This may change. Cultural evolution has been de-Darwinized by its own products, but its Darwinian ancestry is still very much in evidence, and synanthropic, unauthored memes, like the bacteria that outnumber and outweigh us, still surround us every day.